public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 5501, the Department of Administrative Services. Today we hope to finish the Facilities Division, move to the Human Resources Division, and then the State Services Division, and try to get that accomplished by 10:30. So I would invite up to the table Mr. Foster, who was finishing his presentation, and Ms. Parker from Budget and Management. If you would state your names for the records, and obviously this is a subcommittee of the subcommittee, but we will begin.
Good morning.
Begin with you, Mr. Foster.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members. My name is Bill Foster. I'm the Administrator of the Facilities Division of the Department of General Administrative Services. I believe where we left off was page 49.
You have to kind of look at me and look at him, and then look at Dallas.
Okay.
Sweep the room.
Capital construction.
Okay.
Thank you.
The capital construction budget is included in Senate Bill 5504 that will be heard later in the session by another subcommittee of Ways and Means. And it provides for critical component replacement and asset protection projects costing more than $500,000 in contrast to the capital improvements and any new construction. For 0305, including some action by the emergency board, we had a total of $62 million. What is currently in the governor's recommended budget is $28 million of projects. The department's budget...
I'm sorry, what page are you on?
Oh, that's the 49.
Okay. I just had to change books and I lost my place again. Thank you.
The department's 0507 budget request focuses on funding for the final phases of projects started in previous biennia, critical component replacements, renovation of two buildings, planning for future biennial projects, and planning for a future mall building parking structure. The budget request includes the following. Approximately $680,000 for roof replacements, $4,162,000 for the final or next phase of five projects, $20,001 to renovate two buildings, $250,000 to plan future biennial projects, and $2.5 million for multiple building data center conversion.
Madam Chair,
Senator Morsette.
It begs the question: $20,001,000.
Madam Chair, Senator Morsette. From time to time, the best strategy seems to be to put a $1 limitation into the budget, which gives a point of entry to come back and discuss with the emergency board adjusting the limitation, where some of the things aren't real clear about the full amount that is needed, and so that's just a typical methodology.
Even if it has a $20 million in front of it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm going to ask the professional staff to comment as well.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The $20 million here is for one building. The $1 is a placeholder for another renovation, and the practice has been sometimes in the past to put a $1 limitation as a placeholder. The issue I'd like to bring forward to the committee, though, is that that shouldn't mitigate the need for a discussion, a thorough discussion about that project. Sometimes a dollar, we pass over it, and then later on there's a presentation of the emergency board that this was approved by the legislature because it approved the $1 placeholder. So we need to have a discussion on the record about that project, regardless of the limitation, because truly, when if you're approving the dollar, then you should have had a discussion saying, yeah, we approve the project conceptually, and now go forward and start to develop it. But that discussion quite often doesn't have the depth and breadth that it should have in this process.
Well, I'm going to ask that we flag the whole capital construction as an area that has to be discussed in much more detail before this budget is moved. In a period of severe fiscal constraint still facing us, this is an area that I think will profit from some additional committee discussion. Okay, please continue, Mr. Poisson.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I was at the $2.5 million for the multiple data center conversion. This is a kind of follow-up piece of the computing network infrastructure consolidation project, where we're moving computers out of certain buildings, and this is what it's going to take to bring them back into condition to be used for office when those are finished.
Okay.
The next item is $500,000.
Does this contemplate all 12 of the participants that are going to be involved in the consolidated network center?
Madam Chairman, Chair, it basically is focused primarily on the employment building and the revenue building. Those are the biggest ones. There's some smaller pieces. Some of them don't have a large enough computing center that there really is anything to convert.
I think the thing that is worrisome to me in this display and your explanation is, when does somebody, whether it's DAS, you, say, speak now or forever hold your peace, so that we don't have then building conversions trickle in from the other 12, or so that the legislature can get a complete idea of what it's going to cost to rehab these buildings. When is the list not to be added to?
Madam Chair, this is a somewhat difficult question. Some of the details of exactly what pieces of equipment are moving from where to where are still being worked on as we're moving ahead with this project. As a consequence, you know, we have done our very best guess at what's going to be impacted. But until some of that additional information is available, we don't absolutely know.
Well, that's fair. But I think the plan here is to minimize surprises.
Yes. Madam Chair, the bulk of the work, unquestionably, though, is in the two buildings, the employment building and the revenue building.
Thank you.
The next project is $500,000 to plan a future mall building and parking structure. The next is a $1 limitation.
I can't pass that one. Future mall building to house, fill in blank.
Well, Madam Chair, we're trying to work toward ultimate build-out of the Capitol Mall over time. And one of the plans that we have had on the table for consideration was to construct a smaller building and a parking structure on the red lot, which is the area that is to the east of the revenue building. And that would be adding additional square footage that we can put agencies into over a 4-year period of time.
Mr. Foster, you haven't answered my question. What agencies? Because what you're saying is build it and they will come. And if you want to spend $500,000 to plan for a building, and just to say we're building out the mall, doesn't answer my question.
Madam Chair, there are a number of agencies that really belong on the mall, and this project would initiate a planning process to really figure out exactly who should be the next agency in line. At this point, as we would discuss it, it's several possibilities, not a specific one.
Good. Why don't you share the several possibilities with us?
Well, some of the types of agencies, and, you know, we haven't had detailed discussions with them, you know, corrections really should belong on the mall. Youth authority should belong on the mall.
As decided by who?
Well, this is per trying to follow the statutory guidance of putting in the city of Salem and other kinds of planning efforts about where, what the mall is used for and who should be there. And the goal has always been to have the administrative headquarters of agencies on the Capitol Mall.
Whose plan?
Well, it's a residual of the Capital Planning Commission and things that have worked out with the City of Salem, and there's a certain amount of guidance and statute toward that end.
I would very much appreciate if you would get to our staff the statutory guidance, the list of the agencies that you're contemplating. Respectfully, I don't think you can ask this body for $500,000 and provide as vague a roadmap as you have just provided. Dallas?
I was just going to add, Madam Chair, when we get to the public employees retirement system, I will be proposing that the legislature begin considering directing them to move to the Salem area for a reason. I'll make clear during that discussion, but that's one agency that I believe should be in the Salem area.
Great. Representative Bavakian.
I just wanted to clarify two things about this $500,000 as well. One of them, this is not to imply that current buildings are already overcrowded. This is simply some other type of notion about consolidating services in one area. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Abakian, yes, it's trying to move towards some longer-term goals of the department, and it is not really addressing a particular short-term need. I think the issue, too, is that a lot of these kinds of things, they're long-term ventures, and this would be set up if this were approved. It would probably be like 6 years before there would actually be someone occupying the building.
My point is just it's not to solve a current overcrowding problem. Yes. It's something different. And the other question is this $500,000 relates only, I would guess, to hiring architects, planners, lawyers, whatever. It doesn't actually involve bricks, mortar, shovels.
Madam Chair,
that's a whole other, much bigger number.
This is true. The statutory guidance that we try to follow on a lot of these more significant expenditures is a four-year budgeting process where we would request some planning funds in one biennium and then get a better idea of the detailed sense of the project and then request the actual construction money in the subsequent biennium. And so that's what we were attempting to put in motion here.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am somewhat outraged, I guess, and maybe I'm coming on too strong. I stay in the Lee Apartments. I've stayed there since 1999. We walk around in the historic old town that is being decimated, destroyed by state buildings, and I'm very concerned about that. 2 years ago, they removed three historic houses. They put them somewhere, I hope. I see absolutely no reason to expand the mall. When I drive in up Court Street by the state prison, right by the National Guard area, there's a huge amount of land. There's land all over the place for expanding buildings to go. I would like to know what the plans are to continue extending north on the mall. You're going to run into the historic area where the mill race runs. You're going to run into all kinds of places that I don't think should be disturbed. I'm really concerned about this now. I spent a lot of time walking around this area in the spring. My wife and I know it fairly well, and I'm disturbed with the expansion of the mall.
Madam Chair, Senator Morrison, the boundaries of the mall are set in statute, and we have not expanded them for many years. It's really just trying to plan the orderly development of what's already there.
Okay, I may see if I can change the statute. That may be something that I would work on, is to take a look at the statutory boundaries of the mall and see if there's an interest with the City of Salem and the Historic Preservation Society to make some changes. Thank you.
Director Warner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lauren Warner, the acting director for the department. To follow up with what Bill is telling you, the mall boundaries are defined and are not moving. Those have been agreed upon with the city. If you notice out here, there are parking lots, surface parking lots, across from the Human Resource Building and across from the Revenue Building. And those those in the long-term plan for the mall, those lots are designed to be built upon state office buildings. Probably three biennia ago, there was a discussion with the legislature about building a building for the attorney general and those folks, and the legislature decided not to do that. That's why we're in the process of renovating their existing building. So, you know, this discussion about how much more buildings should we put on the mall is always a long-term plan, because right now we lease about as much space as we own in the city of Salem and the surrounding areas, and that is more costly for the state than maintaining the buildings on the mall and housing state agencies here. So that study, those studies have been done over time, and I think the statutes reflect that. Now, is the timing right to build a building? I think Bill alluded to here, if you're going to build a building, it takes several biennia to do the planning and work with the city. The city is not willing for the state to build any more buildings on the mall until we build another parking structure, because right now we have one parking space for every two employees, and when the session is in, there's a lot of pressure on the surrounding neighborhoods, and every parking spot is sought after. So I think what we're talking about here are planning funds to begin looking at what should be the next building, if there is one, and then what is the accompanying parking structure or parking arrangements that would have to be done to manage that. The city would prefer that we keep state offices centralized in the core and that they can run their transit systems than have us spread out all across the city, frankly. So we work closely with the city of Salem, and there is not an intention to move the mall beyond its current boundaries. It's a question of, on the parking, surface parking lots we have behind the PUC building, across from DHS, those two lots, when and if should we build another building, and who should move into it over time. So that's what's being talked about here. You know, I think the Attorney General would still like to have a building built on the mall for them, but that is just one in a list of many agencies who would like perhaps to be housed down here so that they're not traveling back and forth down to the mall. These are the headquarters offices, not necessarily their auxiliary functions and case management services and those kinds of
clarification.
Follow-up, if that helps.
I was talking about houses that were moved about 2 to 3 years ago, and I heard a lot of concerns by people who lived in that area. That's north of the boundary of the parking lot.
Yes, Senator Morissette, yeah. Those are historic houses that we in the mall plan agreed to move down there to have a buffer between that north neighborhood and the archives building and state land. So those six or eight houses, I don't remember how many are down there, we're going to maintain them in their historic states and have state agencies housed in those buildings. They're not; those houses are not quite ready for occupancy, but that is the planned schedule. And we work closely with that neighborhood, many meetings. Myself, I've attended them, and they've worked with us pretty closely on keeping that as a buffer area. The landscaping and everything was designed to make it look like a neighborhood, but it will house state agency.
The only other thing I'd like is a map. Could you just
give
me a map?
We can get you.
So I understand what's going on down there.
But you're really talking about approving planning funds here for future potentials, and there needs to be some evaluation of what that would be or not be. I think the parking is going to have to come before any building anyway, just because the city won't approve any permits for building until we've addressed that issue.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. What's happening out by the National Guard area? There's a new development going in. Is that a state development or is that something else?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that's a project with the city for the ball fields. Is that what you're speaking of?
I don't know what's there.
There's a street being put through, but let me have Bill respond.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I'm not sure which one.
Well, it's between the National Guard and the prison. It's that big area in there. They put a road in, and they're starting to develop. And I was wondering if that's a state development or
this. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, the that particular development is a piece of property that the state entered into a long-term lease arrangement with the city of Salem, and it's four ball fields.
Thank you very much. I think you have heard from this discussion our interest in having a little more precision in this presentation, and I think perhaps you have heard in some of the comments some anxiety about capital construction in a time when we are still cutting programs to Oregonians, and just the symbolism of government building new buildings and we're leaving other folks behind. And so I think this will profit from a more thoughtful discussion.
Madam Chair, if I might, one of the distinctions that I think we need to clarify is that the projects that are listed here, for the most part, are no different than those that are listed in the capital improvement budget. They are elements. They just have a higher price tag where we're trying to replace components, finish projects, those kinds of things. The one clear exception to that is the 500 planning money for that we were just discussing.
Right.
So, you know, I think if you kind of look at it, a lot of those are the things that are asset protection. They're the kinds of things that if we don't do, they'll end up on a deferred maintenance list.
Okay. Representative Vakian.
And Dallas, maybe this goes to you. This $500,000, as an example, is another fund amount of money that comes from what source, and is it statutorily restricted to this type of purpose?
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, we have, as a part of our rent program, a fund that comes from capital recovery or depreciation element for the projects that allows this other fund's monies to assemble there for our future use. And, yes, it's dedicated to that purpose in its other funds.
Dedicated by state statute.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in the capital construction bill, which is a separate bill, these projects are listed along with projects from other agencies. And so each of those subcommittees will review in detail and make recommendations then as to what should come forward out of those budget requests to be included in the capital construction bill. And they are specifically, they are line by line, fairly specific. Planning for a future mall building parking structure, the expenditure of those funds would be limited to that purpose alone, not for any additional construction, because there's nothing, no wording for construction there. So it is very specific to that.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
Last two are $1 for the agriculture laboratory improvements, and this project is something that we are trying to work with the Department of Agriculture on what kind of changes and consolidations that they want to do with their laboratories, and they haven't really come to a conclusion. Consequently, we have it in here at a $1 placeholder.
Thank you very much.
And the last one is something that we typically have put into our budget as another placeholder, and that is if and when there's a potential benefit of acquiring systems furniture and doing some conversion to save space in buildings, this would allow that to be exercised.
Thank you.
The source for this is either the capital projects fund that has the source of revenue from the depreciation component of uniform rent, or utilizing certificates of participation. The last thing is we did have some proposed revisions to the governor's recommended budget. And I don't know whether you want to get into the detail of that at this point in time, or whether you would rather revisit that when we have a more detailed discussion of the
Let's save it for a more detailed discussion of the projects.
Okay.
Senator Morris has gone to testify before the Revenue Committee, and so he'll be returning momentarily.
Madam Chair, just
Senator Morris,
before we move on, I guess I would question the wisdom of doing a long-term lease to build a ball field on very valuable state land. Once that ball field's there, you're never going to get rid of it, and that is a huge future. It has huge implications for the future, and I think that's where things should be built in that area rather than here.
Madam Chair, Senator Morsette, unfortunately, what, regardless of our opinions, that was a deal that was entered into about 5 years ago with this city, and I think you're correct.
Okay, thank you.
The key performance measures, the last thing that we have to offer on that is the suggestion that the one item be discontinued, which is the 10735, and that we would plan to explore whether a composite measure of all facilities divisions for competitiveness against some benchmark is something that we could do.
Thank you. That concludes your presentation.
Yes.
Good. All right. Any questions from the panel? There being none, we'll thank you for your presentation. Representative Krupp, at your place is a little synopsis of what happened yesterday so that you know what has occurred. Given your interest in the IRMD material, you'll see noted on there that we have asked them to return for a more detailed presentation.
Wonderful. I was hoping that would occur.
Well, now you have it in writing.
Thank you.
We will invite Ms. Wilson up to the table. Good morning.
Good morning. Get all my papers out. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Wilson. I'm administrator of the Human Resource Services Division in the Department of Administrative Services. And I think you have our materials for the budget presentation.
Under the green tab.
Okay. Starting on page 5, which speaks to the mission of the division. We are here to support the human resource functions in state government. We are the centralized element of state government human resources. In other words, we're responsible for the policies. We're responsible for some of the overall statewide functions, such as collective bargaining. And I think on the page 6, you can see our main core functions. Through policy and facilitation, we do provide statewide leadership in the management of human resources. This enables the state to act as a single employer, which we try to do so that we can apply things consistently across state government. We centrally manage the state personnel system, so all of the data associated with all of the employees in state government is managed through systems that we have and also through consultation to try and do consistent application. We are also now doing some other centralized functions, including the reconciliation of all the retirement data and data entry, which we are now doing centrally for all state agencies.
May I stop you and ask a question that has been a curiosity for me for a long time? You do all the central human resources stuff and develop policies and give guidance to the other agencies. Explain, if you would, the coordination between what you do in your shop and what happens inside the agencies. And the piece that I want to get to is there any opportunity for consolidation so that you could run all of the human resource functions for the agencies out of your office and not have individual agencies have their own human resource functions? I'm trying to think, again, drawing on my experience as a former state agency head. Actually, at that time it was a division. I went to the ODOT human resources people to get assistance. But I wondered how you can assure consistency where you have ODOT with its own, and I'm not picking on ODOT. It's the example.
Yes, you are, Madam Chair. That's okay.
But
you have history there.
But you have human resources in ODOT. You have it in other agencies. Talk about how that coordination works and how you're able to actually deliver services to managers who are dealing with human resource problems inside their divisions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that's an interesting question, and it's something that we have talked about, explored, and the system as it's developed. Yes, in every agency, the agency management hires their own HR staff for the most part. The sizes of those staffs depend, obviously, on the size of the agencies. You will see for some smaller agencies, we do actually provide the human resources. We are their personnel shop. But for the larger ones, those people are hired by the management of those agencies. Our relationship with those folks is, again, a consultative one. It is one where we do set policy and try to set parameters about how they will function within those agencies. Obviously, we've got collective bargaining agreements also, which really mandate how some relationships will take place within those various agencies. We do an audit function, which allows us to go in and see are things being applied consistently. So that allows us in the door to take a look at what's going on. We are setting up, we have set up some less formal relationships where I get together with all the HR managers. We go over policies. We go over their questions.
How large is that universe? How many? How big is the room when you all get together?
There's probably 45 human resource managers that are out there in state agencies. And so we are able to try and work through their problems. I think what we would hear from the agencies is that each department faces unique HR situations, recruitment situations, depending on who their staff is, what type of staff they need, and that they feel the maximum amount of flexibility is needed for them to be able to respond right there and have people being assistants and part of the strategic executive teams of those agencies.
Okay, you just answered the piece I was going to ask, being part of the strategic executive management team of the agency. So they're steeped in the nomenclature of the agency. But the personnel rules shouldn't change from agency to agency. How an employee is treated under the bargaining agreements as well as just the standard treatment of a state employee in any agency shouldn't differ. It shouldn't matter if the business of the agency is building roads or processing tax returns. So why could savings be developed? Has anybody seriously looked at taking those 45 independent shops, or not independent, but autonomous shops, and moving them into a single place, and then you would send out field officers to assist the agencies directly?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's not a specific undertaking that's happened, at least in my tenure in this position in the last couple of years. There may have been discussions earlier. I'm not aware of them if there were. We have looked at other states, and some states do approach things in that way. We just did hear from, I believe it's New Jersey, who actually did that. They're now going back the other direction and decentralizing. So we have that going a variety of directions. I think there probably are some opportunities, and we have talked with the human resource managers about opportunities for taking some elements and sharing those potentially, like the PERS situation that we did. There could be some elements related to perhaps recruitment. We are doing statewide training for managers. So there are some elements where we are trying to bring together the resource and do shared service. But as far as all the shops, we have not had that discussion.
I'm even thinking of an instance where within your shop you would have the same model that LFO and BAM use, where you have you'd have people who intimately knew agencies 1 through 10, and that was in their portfolio so that they would have that benefit of understanding the agency in a little more detail than just a whole shop full of generalists who would, and by generalists I mean people who were not, didn't understand the agencies as intimately. Well, good. At least you're talking about it.
Yeah, great. On page 7, talking about some of the statewide business change initiatives that we have looked at. Again, we are trying to work very closely with other DAS divisions. We're reviewing all the executive branch reclassification packages now, along with budget and management, to ensure that we've got the proper classification decisions being made, again, consistent application.
Ms. Wilson,
yes.
I'm now starting my third session.
Mm-hmm.
I've had the opportunity to be on this panel 3 times. Every time I've been here, I've seen the same sentence. When does it end? we're reviewing all the executive branch reclassification packages to ensure appropriate classification decisions. It's now going on 5 years. I've heard this.
Madam Chair, I don't think it does end. I think we're working closely together now because agencies are continually, as business needs change, as their approaches change, there's going to be reclassifications that are going to be done. Our job is to try and make sure that if they are done, they're done for good business reason along with budget management and to make sure it's the appropriate classification.
How many reclasses do you do in an average year?
In terms of the studies of actual classifications and going...
I've mixed apples and oranges.
Yeah, I want to get back to where you need to go.
I initially asked about just the reclass process to make sure that you have consistent classifications that are easy for agency heads to understand. Then I shifted directions and said, how many reclasses do you actually look at person by person across state government in a year?
Madam Chair, I'd have to take a look at that. The numbers have changed in the last few years because we didn't used to look, for example, at lateral changes. We're now looking at those. So I can get back to you.
I'd like to know that, and I'd like to know if you could look back a couple of years, how many of those reclasses were ever down?
We do have that information. I can get you that. I believe we've got some charts on that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you. This is a... issue dear to my heart.
We're on page 7. Under the
can you, Sue, can you give us a total number of reclass packages that are in the 0507 budget?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, I don't have the specific information on the number that are in the actual budget documents. I would probably need to work with budget management to get that.
Cora, Madam Chair, if I may ask, Cora, is that a doable issue in the next few days for you?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, I will certainly find that out for you. I should be able to fill major elements.
Very good. I would assume, Madam Chair, that if the department is reviewing all of the reclassification packages, that you would have the information available to be able to total how much money that really is. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
As far as statewide business change initiatives, what we have also tried to do is develop and implement a strategic learning plan, which is across the various agencies and bringing together the training resources and trying to determine the best way to leverage the use of those resources. That is a process that we have facilitated and is led through our statewide training and development. We've also, in the last few years, had the opportunity to play a different role in administering and monitoring the governor's administrative restrictions related to the human resource management practice in executive branch agencies. This relates to salary steps upon hire, one step on promotions, being able to have exceptions to the restrictions that the governor did put into place. And we are responsible for reviewing and or approving or disapproving those requests from agencies related to. And I have some specific information related to all of those that I have made available to LFO. I'll make sure that Dallas has those too. Moving on to page 11. Significant changes in the division in the past 10 years. During the last legislative session, our Ways and Means Subcommittee questioned organizationally our management structure. We did take a look at that. We have made some changes and flattened the organization, collapsing some of the more specialty sections in together. We are now at a 1-to-12 management to non-management ratio in our unit. We added the audit unit, which was a legislative decision to add that in the 2001 session. We also have added client services, which is where we actually become the personnel office for some of the smaller agencies. We have looked at that as being something that's cost-effective and is also necessary for risk management on employment risk. And then in the past 10 years, there was legislation which removed the Oregon University System from our purview of Chapter 240 and the shift of personnel then to the university system, which resulted in a loss of about 28 FTE for our division. Under professional services and contracting on page 15, examples of when we do contracts. Our statewide training services. does use outside vendors to deliver primarily the technical training. For example, an agency may come in and say, we have a need for a certain Microsoft training or a certain technical computerized training, not just your basic software. We then put the word out, gather those people from a variety of agencies that may need that, and contract with a vendor to come in and do that. We believe this is more cost-effective than sending individuals off to often out-of-state training, but rather bringing the individual in, opening those up, and we do occasionally, we open those up also to local governments so that we can make the best use of that resource. We also manage a statewide contract for recruitment advertising. If we as a state act as...
How do you work? How closely do you work with local governments? Who do you contact in local government for these things? Just talk a little bit about the local government
involvement. Mr. Chair, basically we work with local government through, especially with the technical training, we work through their IT staff and their managers to find out what they need. These are generally for the folks who are working some of the more complex systems within the state government.
Counties, cities,
that's correct.
And special districts?
The interest list is open to any public entity. The statewide...
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we've had some discussions in this committee previously. I know talked about it with Director Warner, and the Chair Johnson concurs that in the interim, it would be appropriate that we conduct a review of the policies regarding RFPs and how those come about, over concerns that at times there are RFPs that seem to be written in a manner to favor certain companies, and that may in fact disenfranchise Oregon companies. And we've had discussions about specific examples of that in the past that appear that way. And because of that appearance, I would strongly urge that you work with whatever appropriate legislative audits committee in the interim to review this policy, as I think this is an important issue we need to discuss further. With that, Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
We also are required statutorily to contract out for arbitrators when we are involved in labor arbitrations. We are required to use someone from outside of state government to do those arbitrations, and we jointly contract with the unions for those arbitrators. Again, we use, in trying to make decisions about what we do contract, we try to look at what the customer demand is and when it exceeds our capability to deliver that internally, and if we need especially to get a timely response, and when it results in an overall savings and a more efficient use of the resource. And also, obviously, we have those that are told by statute we need to contract out, and in those cases, we do. Under program improvement and cost containments on page 19, I spoke a little bit about our meetings with human resource managers. We also have other stakeholder groups, recruitment managers, training managers, that we bring together on a regular basis to facilitate and get feedback about our programs. Are they meeting their needs? What we might need to be doing, and looking for improvement opportunities through them. We also are working closely with other divisions in DAS because we find that there's often a lot of blend, or what one division may do can certainly affect another. We work very closely with the payroll systems, with budget management, with risk management, and others on employment issues.
The recruitment function, though, is centralized in your shop, is it not?
Madam Chair, there's an element of the recruitment function that is centralized in our shop, but agencies may choose to be, in essence, released from having to go through. Everything needs to go through our central system so that we have all the data associated with the applications and postings to the state jobs page. But agencies can and often do, especially the larger agencies, have their own recruitment function that they run themselves.
I participated in a recruitment for an agency head recently, and I just want to use this opportunity to tell you how well Joe Wall performed. that was really a very, it was a complicated recruitment, and he did some just first-rate staff work with a diverse citizens committee, and this is just an opportunity to say in front of his bosses he did a good job.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing that. On page 20, again, we look at our program improvements and cost containments through areas of cost savings. A lot of user group feedback, and again, new product delivery. Generally, these are new products that may be requested by agencies, and we look to see if we can deliver those to them. Some examples for other program improvement and cost containment. We are trying to reduce our paper reports as much as we possibly can. We'd like to be able to do more web-based work on reporting and letting agencies make some decisions about their reports, and I'll get to that a little bit more when we talk about one of our policy packages. We are limiting memberships in outside organizations, and one of the costs that we have that is relatively high for us is all the system storage on our personnel database. We have a lot of information in there. That electronic storage can be expensive. We are looking at alternative means to have lower costs for that electronic storage.
How long are you required to keep that data?
Madam Chair, we have certain different elements of that are required for different years. However, we find that with the electronic data, especially when we're trying to do information like computing service years, we pretty much keep it for what we've had in the system, which is 1977.
Physically, the stuff that isn't converted to electronic yet, physically, where is all that stuff?
Physically, most of that is in the agencies and in their personnel files. Now, we do have schedules for public records retention that allow you to purge that information after a certain period of time, and we are encouraging agencies to adhere to the purging schedule so that the paper records are not excessive. We look at our cost containment to try to compare cost trends associated with the deliveries of the service. Our data, our personnel database is one specifically. The recruiting is also an area that we are working with national organizations on benchmarks to try and get to our recruiting costs and how they match up. And then, again, effectiveness is pretty much given to us through our customer surveys and through feedback from our stakeholders. A summary of our budget on page 25, talking about the budget drivers that are unique to our division. I mentioned the maintenance cost for what is a legacy data system. That's a system that was built for us, is maintained specifically for us, and is, as is sometimes termed, a lot of our systems are getting elderly. The storage, we spend probably about $17,000 a month currently on our storage, and our monthly costs for programming and maintaining this system are about $27,000 a month. That is something that is now done by information resource management staff, and we are working with them now to try and look at alternative means both for storage and for maintaining the program. Again, with a legacy system, we're going to be at a higher cost associated with that.
Madam Chair?
Representative Crump.
Thank you. Is DAS responsible for, or are we still maintaining the Burns Data Center?
Madam Chair, Representative Crop, that's not something that we are responsible for. I think probably the IRMD staff will speak to that, but to that element.
Not IRMD staff.
But I understand.
Yes, the Burns Archive is still being maintained by the Information Resource Management Division.
Okay, we'll ask that question of them when they get here. Thank you.
Some of the other drivers within our budget are associated with interest arbitration for labor disputes. We have a number of labor organizations that are non-strikeable, our corrections guards, state police, and others. If they go to interest arbitration, we have to, again, pay legal costs. We have to hire arbitrators, and we do have those costs associated with those things that are specified in binding arbitration. We also have a fair budget piece associated with Attorney General costs. And this is something that we have looked at and I have tried to work with the Attorney General's office on. What, again, we're trying to get to is I don't have a problem if we feel there is a statewide issue to go to the Attorney General's office to try to get assistance or to try to get an interpretation that we can then get out to agencies. I think this is more effective than having each agency with their particular HR problem go to the Attorney General and pay on their own. So our costs are high in the Attorney General area because I think we're trying to provide a service and we work very closely with them in interpretation of policy and statute.
I know we have the detail, but would you just share with us so we're not all scrambling through the books, what's high?
We are probably at, I know in our budget it's approximately $245,000. I think our actual expenditure is higher than that. Probably over $300,000.
Are you the gatekeeper then for all of the agency contacts to the Attorney General, or the big agencies, are they also going to the Attorney General to ask for human resource clarification?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, agencies do on their own. Again, if they have a situation that's very unique, they may be going to the Attorney General.
Who's the arbiter on unique? Do they have to get an okie-dokie from you to go forward?
Madam Chair, no, we don't. Again, we try to, through our conversations, let agencies know when we think there's a policy that we want to get Attorney General help on, so they are aware of what it is that we are, what we're asking. However, in situations where there may be, particularly I think in discipline situations, where an agency may want to make sure that they're taking the right steps, they may go directly to the Attorney General on those cases.
Is there any formalized reporting, even after the fact reporting, so that someone is tracking? I completely understand in the discipline you want to do that correctly, but I'm just trying to get a sense of how many human resource questions get asked of the Attorney General's shop, and if you're giving guidance to the agencies, what's the mechanism by which they would report back their contacts with the Attorney General? And I'm not looking at the substance of the contacts. I'm looking at the cost of the contracts. And if we're just reinventing the wheel over and over and over again, I would look to you as the Department of Administrative Services to be at a minimum the repository of these reports and at a maximum doing some level of analysis to see if there are any Attorney General savings.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that our work with, we work mostly with the Labor and Employment Section and the General Counsel at DOJ. We meet with the attorney in charge of that on a regular basis to get a sense of what are the questions that are coming in, what are the issues that are going on. They generally will alert us if they are getting a question that they know either we've asked, other people have asked, so that we can maybe swing around and get back to the agency for us to deal with it instead of the Attorney General's office. So at this point in time, most of that monitoring and reporting is coming between myself and some of my staff and the attorneys at DOJ who keep us in the loop. We do not have a formal mechanism with the HR managers.
Okay.
We did talk about our data storage costs. On page 26 is our revenue history.
Can I back up one?
Please.
Back to the role of the Attorney General's office with the agencies, I've had more than one agency pose the question to me, maybe we'd like to go out and hire our own in-house lawyer as opposed to trying to negotiate rates, which you can't really even negotiate with the AG's office. What's the status or the policy or the protocol of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, I actually spent a few years at the Department of Justice, and I know that question comes up a lot. There is actually statutory language that requires that the Attorney General be the only attorney for the state, and if an outside attorney is desired, the Attorney General can approve that, but it all goes through the Attorney General as a gatekeeper for attorney support. And again, I think the purpose is so that there is consistently legal application across the state.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crump.
In that regard, if the Attorney General's office decides to utilize outside legal advice, do they do that when it comes to writing Attorney General opinions?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, I think probably that it's the best question associated for the Attorney General's office, and I don't want to get former colleagues upset with me. I think...
Since you worked there.
Well, I did, yes, but I'm not an attorney.
And you don't play one on television either.
No, I don't.
That's good.
Or on the radio.
I think in a lot of cases the Attorney General determines how the information received from an outside approved attorney will be used. I know that we have had information and research from an outside attorney used for an Attorney General's opinion before, whether or not it's specifically from them. But it's signed by the department.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please continue.
My apologies.
Okay, back to human resources.
And actually, as you're sort of catching your place, I want to dive back a little bit, too.
Okay.
All this data storage costs is really stunning to me. When you add up the maintenance costs for the legacy system plus the storage costs, that's $45,000 a month.
That's correct.
And
Madam Chair, by the way, that doesn't include the Burns Archive Center costs, or even higher than that.
Okay, thank you.
For context.
I guess I feel sort of a sense of urgency about hunting for solutions to this. And you touched on some of them, but how aggressively is your section pursuing this?
Madam Chair, we're really being fairly aggressive in our pursuit of this because we think that there's an immediate savings that we might see. There's short-term and long-term solutions. Short-term being, what can we do with data storage? Long-term is one of our policy packages that we have in the development of a human resource information system, which would get us to technology that doesn't require the legacy programming in the specific, right now if we want to make a change in a field in this particular program, which is in essence a storage, it's a storage cabinet, that's what it was built for. It's not necessarily meant to really give you good reports. To try and generate reports out of that takes a lot of programming. So a lot of the reports that we're presenting to the legislature take a great deal of programming and hours for us to do. That's why we're looking for a system that will allow us to web-enable, to do some things, and really reduce those overall costs in the long run for maintenance of the system. Our revenue history, Human Resource Services Division, is pretty much exclusively supported by assessments to the agencies. Right now, our assessment rate in the 0507 budget is $15.33 per FTE a month. For 0305, it was $14.92 per FTE. Again, the increase in cost comes mostly through inflation, through some increases in our policy packages to try and provide more service. We also do charge fees for our training programs, and we bring in that additional, the fee revenue there of about $2.5 million for our training programs and supplies and associated materials with those training programs.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crawford.
A couple of questions about your assessment procedures and policies. Mm-hmm. You do not have to have, or do you have to have, rather, I should ask the question, legislative approval for assessments in terms of the rate of assessment to other agencies?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, via the budgetary process, basically by your adoption of their budget, you are, in essence, adopting their assessment schedule.
And Madam Chair, follow up, please.
Yes.
So we're adopting the assessment schedule. Is the assessment schedule a flexible schedule that allows you during the interim to increase assessments?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, typically not.
Madam Chair, define typically for me, please.
I knew that would be the follow-up question to that response. I say typically only because I certainly do not want to be on record saying this has absolutely never happened, because I can't make that emphatic statement. I don't know for certain that it has not. But generally, the assessments that are adopted during the budgetary process would allow for the revenue that would support the level of expenditure, since expenditures cannot be changed unless there is an e-board action or some other legislatively adopted action. There would not necessarily be a reason for the revenue level to change as well. So that's the little bit of a caveat there.
Madam Chair, the reason I ask this series of questions is because I have heard a rumor, and we would like it substantiated or not, that there have been moments in the last biennium where assessments were increased during the interim between agencies, and then to achieve a certain level of monetary revenue, and then they were rescinded or reduced before the beginning of the legislative session. And while, Cora, your point is well taken in that expenditure authority is one thing. If the money is, if that scenario were to take place, you wouldn't necessarily have, it could be used for backfill issues, you wouldn't necessarily have to seek additional expenditure authority. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, I would need to know the specific type of situation that you were speaking about before I could respond.
Let's just say for the benefit of the committee that we would like to have a synopsis of any interim increases in assessment. And I think it would be very useful, and perhaps it's in here and I just have overlooked it, but to have all of the assessments by division detailed in one place.
They are, Madam Chair. They're in the appendix.
Okay. I'm sorry that I have missed that.
Madam Chair, forgive me. I need to testify on one of my bills. I'll be right back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm trying to figure out which it's the pink tab?
Yeah.
The price pink. List of goods and services. The appendix B, which details the methodology and all of them for the Department of Administration.
Right. This I have seen. The director was nice enough to give me a copy of this, but what I'm trying to figure out is in this document, a way we struggled with the agency numbers, and I don't know how to get this in a display where it's a little easier to understand rather than having the numbers. Is there a guide that there is, that accompanies the numbers so that you can actually look up what they are? But what I'm trying to figure out is, and maybe I'm just too dense to read this, you have a $15, and I'm rounding the number, you have a $15 per head charge for your services to agencies. We heard from PEB yesterday, and they had a $2.50 per head charge for some of their services. These are in the aggregate, and I'm trying to ascertain where is a display that shows me per FTE the following charges apply. So that there's the $2.50 for this, there's the $15 for you, there's the $27.50 for somebody else. This displays it in the aggregate, and I'm trying to get a little bit finer detail. And I know that in some cases you do it per FTE. What other methodologies are there, like per computer terminal or per gross whatever of the agency? I'd like to know the summary of all of the assessment methodologies. Maybe you could just tell me what they are. There's per head, per computer station, per...
Madam Chair, there are a number of different, depending on whether you're talking about an assessment and or you move quickly into that sort of service charge, fee-for-service area as well. The most common is, I think, for assessment purposes, is FTE. There are also some things that are based on magnitude of dollars that run through an agency. I'm thinking about some treasury charges.
That's what I was talking about. Gross, whatever gross is.
Exactly. There are a number of different ways of applying that, but I think it would be relatively easy to put a summary together that
If that is not burdensome, I'd like the summary of the different methodologies. There can't be more than, 10 of them? Okay, so, and then the indication of the per head.
And Madam Chair, let me confirm, too, if you're speaking just about the department's assessments versus statewide other agencies that assess, you're focusing just on the Department of Administrative Services?
I was when I asked the question, but now that
perhaps I shouldn't.
Now that you've cracked the door open further, you've whetted my curiosity for what other
fabulous. I'll be rewarded for that, I'm sure.
Let's just start with DAS so that we see the magnitude of the inquiry and move beyond it once we have that display. I'm just trying to figure out a way to be able to think about this in terms of. I'm the head of a small agency somewhere, and I look out over my employees. There are 30 of them, and I'm just trying to understand per head, and I'm using that as the most graphic example, what all applies to that person sitting in that desk that are specifically related to running your agency. Thanks.
Again, our revenue history changes for the most part are related a lot to client agencies and some of the money that we're getting in from client agencies now that we're doing more of that kind of work. On page 28 is our spending history, which shows our non-limited and our limited expenditures. Our non-limited expenditures have gone up because we absorbed in the technical training unit, because that's a pass-through situation where they are providing centralized training through the vendor and then they collect from the agencies. We have that in a non-limited fund because we don't know the extent of how much they're going to be doing during a biennium. And on page 29, our full-time equivalents, we are 0305, 54.5, moving to 58.5 because of the policy packages that we have, which we'll be going over here in a few moments. Our overall budget summary on page 30, we are other funded totally, $13.9 million is the biennial budget recommendation for 0507. Our policy option package is starting on page 31. Package 350 is the client agency workload, and this is where we are adding a one FTE position to again provide direct personnel services to agencies. We have a number of agencies who have made the election to come and use our services during this next biennium, and so we're adding at least 3, possibly 4 agencies to our current client services list. We think this is a good thing because in many of these cases, these agencies are so small that they may have just a teeny portion of an FTE who's trying to do their personnel work, and the risk of that is great. We would like to be able to have them have full service.
I think that's a good thing. I'm addressing a more global question, and I'm probably speaking to the director as I'm making this question, and that is to what degree you can provide backroom services for other agencies or boards or commissions. And I'm thinking of instances where there were commissions, very small, running without oversight that got into serious financial problems. And I'm trying to envision a scenario by which DAS provided backroom services for lots of those organizations. I don't want them to lose their front counter identity, but it seems to me that many of the backroom functions could be handled through your shop, and by your shop I mean DAS globally, not just the HR piece of DAS. with no diminution of the boards or commissions' ability to be advocates for the industry groups they serve or the professional sectors that they serve. Accounting is accounting, HR is HR, gift receipting is gift receipting. Ledger books seem to me to have no identity. You wouldn't want to diminish the persona of the agency or board or commission to the public or how to find them, but to look for genuine savings in having this large, small agency amalgamated back room, and particularly boards and commissions that are not traditionally state agencies, but could perhaps find savings in amalgamated back rooms.
Madam Chair, I think there will be a number of divisions of DAS that will speak to this. I think Bill Fink the other day spoke about the payroll services that are offered to a number of boards and commissions. The State Controller's Division also has a client services, shared client services group that does exactly what you say. They do the accounting, they do the receipting, they do those kinds of things for a number of the smaller agencies. We can probably put together a list of those agencies that we are working with and what services we're providing for them if that would be of assistance.
I would like that very much because in the interest of full disclosure, the direction that I'm heading is less the opportunity to shop fee for service than I am legislative direction to do those amalgamations, and I know that comes suffused with a lot of politics because of the concern about the loss of identity in the front counter. But I certainly think that it would be worth some degree of exploration, and given that you are the coordinating agency for the executive department, you seem the logical repository of the investigation.
We'll provide that information.
Cool. Thanks.
The cost of adding the client service position is $146,000 in other funds. Again, the purpose is to try to spread the cost and to ensure that small agencies have the professional services they need. Our package 361, which is the human resource information system that I spoke of earlier, what we are looking for in this is simply one FTE to do the evaluation and build the business case for where we need to be looking at this. We're looking at this not just in terms of what we currently have in our personnel database. There are a number of systems in state government, and we currently don't interact. And Senator Johnson, I know you asked yesterday people talking about systems and saying they're old and antiquated and who owns them. Well, we own this one. And we are trying to take the lead on this to try to get somewhere. Currently, our position, the information about positions that are in the budget resides in one database in budget management. We have the payroll system that resides in State Controller's Division. And then we have the personnel information about the employees. We have to download to the payroll system. We can't get reports out of the payroll. If you ask me how much sick leave employees have used, I can't tell you that. I have to go to the payroll system. They have to program to get a run. We're trying to put together, get a study and get a business case built to show what we could be able to do and what we might be able to function with in getting a system put together that will bring us to a much more modern state. So that's the purpose of this.
You then will put out an RFP to do this work.
Eventually, we would. For this, actually, we would be bringing in a full-time person to work with all the entities in building the business case, and potentially we also do have money in here for professional services to be able to have us, yes, put out a bid to try and have someone help build the business case for us.
Representative Avakian.
This database that you have through this system that pertains to personnel matters, some of the agencies have their own system as well. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, not for the actual employee information. We are the official database. Now, have agencies, because of the lack of the ability to get reports out of our system, put together some software or other databases to try and give them management information? Yes. That has happened, and I have been talking with agencies. We have some agencies who have purchased what are called learning management systems to be able to track the training of individuals within that particular department. We're trying to get all these folks in to work together, but we are the official employee database.
Follow-up.
And I'm not implying that that was something wrong. There are probably reasons why they've done that, but does any of this in package 361 enable your ability to do something comprehensive with whatever systems they have going independently?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, that's part of the discussion and part of the research that we would have to do on this in building the business case is what are the systems that are out there? What can we take advantage of? Is there a possibility of these being able to be blended somehow and make use of those data? We don't know that, and that's what we need to find out.
Okay, thank you. We're now turning over to page 34.
Okay, and I think, again, this is what we've talked about in terms of what this would add in terms of flexibility in the business system and the ability to meet the missions and the objectives and provide information. Our next budget package is on page 36, package 362. This is the statewide PERS administrative support and reconciliation. What we have done in this biennium, because it became a critical need, was to establish a limited duration position so that we could begin to provide this service to state agencies. Very well received, both with the agencies and with PERS, as PERS only then has to deal with us as one employer and not contact 125 or however many agencies separately through PERS. So this is actually putting this into our budget as a permanent position.
Senator Morissette.
Okay, you added a part-time, but now you're making it.
We added a limited duration.
A limited duration,
which would expire at the end of the biennium, and this would create a permanent position for that.
Good.
On page 38, our package 421, which transfers a training specialist. Bill Fink spoke about this during his presentation. There was a trainer within Department of Administrative Services Personnel Office. Department of Administrative Service, as in most agencies, has their own personnel office. They had a training person in there who was being used exclusively. We discussed that it was a much better use of leverage of resources to put him into the statewide group. His services can now be used statewide, and that's how we're doing that. So that's the transfer of that one position. And then package 422 on page 39, we had a position that had been involved in some recruitment areas. We have not had to use that position. We transferred that position over to the risk management division, and they are using that for some programs that they need, and they will speak to that specifically. Performance measures, which the first one is on page 43. We have two key performance measures that we are using right now to assist us with statewide programs. One is the percentage of turnover as an indication of the retention within state government. The other is a percentage of state employees who are minorities compared with the available state workforce that's out there and the percentage of state workforce that is minority. We talked about these in our last presentation as to where we are in the work that we're trying to do to get those, particularly in the minority area, to increase the minority recruitments. We have another performance measure related to state management competencies, and we believe that we need to review that particular measure. Right now, standard competencies have not been established across state agencies. A number of agencies have some key ones of their own, but we've not arrived to a consistent across state government. We also have no central mechanism by which to measure the amount of training that's being received by state managers. Again, we hope maybe as part of the new system we might be able to begin to gather some of that information. Right now that's maintained by the agencies in some cases in fairly crude paper formats and in others in databases.
It's an area that I think is incredibly important, and I will just share with you anecdotally something that happened in my district. Extremely competent parks employee assigned to a specific task. Job recruitment, opportunity for professional advancement, does all the paperwork, and because of I guess I'll characterize it sort of maladroit handling in the recruitment process, ends up not even being considered. Immediately leaves state service. and is hired within hours by the city of Vancouver. My curiosity is, how well are these minimum qualifications, standard competencies being embedded in your activities? I mean, I understand that in thousands of state employees that come and go out of the system in any given period of time with just regular attrition and turnover and retirement, and it's going to happen, but I'm trying to get as objective a set of criteria and standard competencies adopted so that you don't have instances where somebody who's performing extraordinary work on a specific high-profile project doesn't even make the minimum list.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you touch on a number of issues that are sort of near and dear to where we are, a lot of which is workforce development, a lot of which is now going to be succession planning, a lot is what we're facing with the workforce. We are going to be in competition for skilled workers, and we're going to have to really work to develop those people so that they are available. And we need to make sure that our systems accept those people into the system. We are looking to try to put management training out there and available to people, and especially those who may be interested but don't have the background, and to try to get those areas and get people built. And we are working with agencies on that. It is a concern, and I share your concern.
I think you've touched on something terribly important, and that's the succession planning, particularly in information technology, where you have one person who is the repository for a great deal of highly technical information, and they leave for Madagascar. That's a problem.
It is. It is, and we're really trying to look at some of these things. It's not just, I mean, IT is certainly an area. I'd say management is one of our biggest concerns, as we don't have a lot of bench strength. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Avakian.
Your comments were related to the third one regarding management competency training, not the other one on minorities, right?
That's correct.
That's correct.
Can I jump back to the minorities?
Sure. We're going back to page 43.
Right. Could you, and I have just a couple questions.
Please, just take them in succession.
Could you give me the definition of minorities?
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, for most of the things that we use the EEO, the Equal Employment Opportunity Federal Codes, to determine what a minority is. And those are the codes. It's generally ethnic. Those codes have expanded in the last couple of years.
Is there a separate from this performance measure one that relates to people with disabilities?
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, disabilities are actually included, I believe, in those EEO codes, but I will confirm that for sure. I know those are numbers we have gathered, and we do have those numbers.
And then, while I think it's a completely laudable goal for us to do this, could you talk just a little bit about how that goal really relates to a gauge of the performance of your agency?
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, I think it is an overall state policy goal that our division, as the sort of central HR, is responsible, or we're assuming responsibility for trying to assist this in happening. A lot of this happens due to recruitment, how recruitment is done, how the jobs are set up, the cultural competency within agencies, and the environment by which people are brought into agencies, and that the openness of agencies to accepting minority candidates. So through a lot of that work, and we work closely with the Affirmative Action Office on that also, we do carry some responsibility in trying to set the standards for recruitment.
Is that responsive?
Well, let's just move on.
Okay. I know Senator Morissette has a question, but before we move on, I think we have some young people from the PAGE program that are here visiting the Capitol today, and I'm going to ask each one of you to stand and tell us what your name is and where you're from. Can we start with this gentleman in the blue shirt on the end? Great. And what school are you from? Great. I think you're a constituent of mine. The next gentleman? Great. And what year are you in school? Right? Thank you. Well, it's very nice that all of you could join us here in the Capitol. This is a subcommittee of the committee that writes the budget for the state of Oregon, and we are in the process of talking to the agency that coordinates the work of other agencies, and we're discussing with them some of their programs. We're talking about personnel and hiring practices today. And so this committee goes until 10:30, when I think you all will come up and help on the floor of the House or the Senate. Is that, are you going to work on the floor of the House or the Senate?
The Senate.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming. You're welcome to stay as long as you'd like and enjoy your day in the Capitol. Okay. Senator Morissette had a question.
Well, I just want to comment on your performance measure on management competency, and I think it's great, and I, too, have an incident that I don't want to talk about right now, but I will discuss it with you. But I think that definitely is moving in the right direction, is to get a handle on standards and competencies out there. So, good job.
Okay, we're on page 45, heading to the home stretch.
Yes, indeed. Page 45, a new performance measure that we are looking to adopt again, since we have taken on the centralized PERS reconciliation. I think it's important for us to establish a measure to find out how we're doing and if we can set some standards for that particular action, since it's a new project for us. And it would be related to the timeliness and the accuracy of the data and the work that we're doing with PERS.
I just want to ask legislative fiscal staff whether or not this committee will be asked to act on each one of these performance measures, or the agency is presenting these as their internal management guidance and we'll instead stay at a higher level for the entire agency.
Madam Chair, when we get to the work session, we'll probably go through each of these real quickly and then with a notation to agree with them, to either to establish one, to review and come back to the, with direction to come back to the audit committee during the interim, or to accept them. So.
Great.
Yeah, may I just,
Senator Morissette.
Yeah, I just want to say that of all the performance measures that I've seen, I think these are the best.
Thank you.
Because I've been concerned that a lot of measures are simply activities rather than trying to achieve quality. And that's certainly what you're doing. These are great performance measures.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Wilson. Unless there are any other questions from the committee, we will thank you for your presentation and ask Mr. Hartwig to join us at the table to discuss the State Services Division budget request. Good morning. If you'd state your name for the record.
My name is David Hartwig. I'm administrator of the State Services Division within the Department of Administrative Services. I'd like to quickly go through the first part of this material because much of it was presented to you in our first presentation.
We're going to have to ask you to pull the microphone closer and
speak louder.
Speak more loudly, please.
Thank you. On page 7, you'll see our mission statement. It's to provide value-added risk management, procurement, fleet, and surplus services that enable state agencies to accomplish their public mission.
Mr. Hartwig, I'm going to point out to you that our pages are numbered differently than yours, and so this is our page 5, and I just wanted to make sure that you knew there was a discrepancy there.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It's page 5 for me as well. I misspoke.
Oh, okay, great.
The bifocals maybe aren't working out. Back to our mission statement. Also, you'll find a reference to the statutory authority for each of our program operations. Regarding significant changes within the past 10 years, moving to page 9, wanted to focus primarily on the change in July 2004 that consolidated the risk management division with procurement, fleet, and surplus services. When I was with you during phase one, I gave you a rather detailed description of the changes that procurement, fleet, and surplus services had undergone over the last 10 years or so. This is the most most recent change that combined the four program areas.
Thank you all for joining us today. Excuse me for interrupting you. And we'll see you up on the floor of the Senate. Thanks for visiting your capital. Bye-bye.
In regard to professional services and purchasing contracts, I'm moving to page 13. Each program area...
Let me come back and revisit a point about the surplus property. I believe that there's discussion right now about you absorbing some of the work of Division of State Lands with respect to some of their surplus property. Am I correct, or do I misunderstand that?
Madam Chair, I wouldn't say you're incorrect, but that's an area that I'm not familiar with.
I think that's treasurer and unclaimed property.
I'm sorry. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Page 13 regarding contracting and services. Each of our program areas obtains services and contracts specific to their operational function and responsibility. I listed some examples for you in regards to fleet. We enter an agreement to conduct fleet review each biennium. We occasionally will enter an agreement for information technology consultants. Our state procurement office has sought strategic sourcing consultants in regards to purchasing strategy, training consultants, information technology consultants, and audit consultants.
Let's just talk about fleet for a second, and for the benefit of our colleagues who have just come back from testifying, we're under State Services Division. It's a white tab. We are on page 13, Professional Services and Purchasing Contracts.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With respect to fleet, are you also then developing policy issues around fleet, for example, procurement and the policy debate about financing that with certificates of participation? Is that under your purview?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is, and that will parts of those will be incorporated in my presentation.
Thank you.
Moving to risk management on the same page, we have obtained actuarial consulting services, services of insurance broker, conflict counsel, independent adjuster services, and we anticipate obtaining property appraisers in regards to processing Measure 37 claims.
Let's visit that for just a second, because I think that appraisals are going to be an integral part of how cities, municipalities, local government, state government all deal with these claims. Fill out for us a little bit. Will you have a menu of appraisers who meet certain minimum standards? Will these be contract appraisers who simply serve the state? Will you be able, once you've established professional credentialing, to make referrals to local government?
Madam Chair,
or none or all of the above?
Well, we haven't contemplated making referrals to local governments, but we have discussed how we might obtain appraisers to do this service. We haven't made a formal decision as to whether or not we would have a group of appraisers where we would basically rotate a list, or if we would contract directly with a single provider of those services. One of the things that we're trying to get a sense for is how we do that statewide, because we have claims that come from all of our counties, and so the difficulty for us is trying to determine how to have an appraiser do work in Burns, someone else do work in Medford. And so we haven't concluded how best to do that.
I might just suggest for your review that this could be an area where you could be of considerable assistance to local government in developing some minimum qualifications. I think that appraisal services will be in very high demand as we begin to figure out how we grapple with the complexities of ballot measure 37. And to the degree that there could be some central repository to at least visit what would constitute minimum qualifications. And just as you've wisely pointed out, how do you get appropriate professional services across the whole state of Oregon where there are differing local issues and the subtleties that go into an appraisal? And I certainly don't know what they all are. I just know it's a very complex science and art to get comparables and all the rest of that. I know many small municipalities who may be dealing with Measure 37 claims are struggling to know what are the technical resources that they'll need to process those claims. And some guidance or assistance or at a minimum coordination with the League of Cities and the Association of Counties might render a very valuable service to our delivery partners who are grappling with this extraordinarily complex ballot measure.
Follow up on that, Madam Chair.
Senator Morsett.
I would include the local COGS because they do. They also provide services to some of the small jurisdictions.
Madam Chair, I would mention that we have met with the head of the Appraisers Certification Board and the president of the Statewide Appraisers Association, so we are talking with them about getting their input about what those criteria and experience and certification backgrounds that we would want to require for those that we would contract with.
And touching on a theme that my colleague, Representative Krupp, has raised on a number of occasions, that if we are going to develop minimum credentials to have work in this complex arena recognized, that we make sure that the credentialing is sufficiently objective, that we are not focusing our attention on a firm or an out-of-state firm, but that we make sure that of all the competent appraisers that reside in this state, we make a level playing field to make sure that they can present their credentials for this complex work.
Absolutely.
Senator Morsett.
Just a clarification. You will contract with various firms or you may contract with various firms? What about local government contracting?
Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, we haven't decided exactly what our strategy will be, so my response would be was we may contract.
Thank you. Moving along.
Yes. Page 14, the division also uses state purchasing contracts that are in place to obtain the lowest possible prices as possible. Moving to program improvements and cost containment activities on page 17, we indicate how we evaluate our success in our program provision. The division uses a variety of techniques to evaluate our effectiveness for our services. We issue customer service surveys. We obtain suggestions from stakeholders, customers, employees, and advisory groups. We use consultant reviews of our programs when appropriate. We also have many internal reports, and we also follow our performance measures and compare how we are performing and regarding those measures.
Do you ever track any standard things that state government uses on a routine basis? I'm thinking paper, for example. One can't come into one of these hearing rooms and not think about paper. Do you track specific purchasing segments to see if there's any trending or any edification with respect to usage or respect to how efficacious your bulk purchasing is?
Madam Chair, I think I understand your question. Our most recent attempt to do this, I would say, was part of our strategic sourcing activity for Oregon Smart Buy office supplies was part of that analysis. Detailed analysis was done for each agency's purchase of office supplies, which would include paper. So we have gathered information about where the purchases are made, what the historical purchases are, and we're in the process of setting up a way to monitor the buying by agencies to check back against that historical buying practice and how our price agreement is, how effective it is in meeting agency needs.
Yeah, you understood my question perfectly. Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you. David, good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Last time you were here on the 2nd of February, I asked for fuel, all the fuel types that we purchase in the state of Oregon, and I know you've prepared that for me. And then also a cost comparison of vehicle operating costs for the different types of vehicles that we have here in the state of Oregon. And I know your numbers are probably out of date, given fuel prices' extreme rise in the last couple of weeks.
but would like for, I know we have operating cost differences between hybrid vehicles that we have at the state level and obviously gasoline, diesels, midsize pickups, those types of things.
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, I believe that we submitted some material back to the committee regarding those questions, but let me see if I can respond here.
Just to point out to you that in Appendix B, there are the answers to some of those questions that you posed.
Wonderful. Thank you.
In regards to alternative fuels, I believe we presented you information about the number of gallons for a variety of fuels that we utilize from gasoline to biodiesel to diesel to compressed natural
right.
gas. In response to your question about the operating expenses, I don't have with me, I should put it that way, cost comparisons between alternative fuel vehicles such as those that are operated by compressed natural gas compared to those that are operated by gasoline. I don't have those with me. I believe that's something that we can provide for you at a subsequent time.
Okay. Thank you. That would be very much appreciated. Yeah. To the entire committee through staff, it would be fine.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ed, please continue.
In regard to cost containment activities, we feel that Department of Administrative Services in general and our division are positioned to initiate enterprise-wide cost containment activities. The activities that I want to highlight with you today are examples of how we've responded to your expectation of being more businesslike and seeking a high level of efficiency and effectiveness. We believe our activities also reflect the direction of the governor that government be stable, responsible, and accountable. Some of these initiatives will represent a new way of doing business. Others are enhancements on current processes that we participate in. What I want to do today is just give you the essence of the activity and try to portray to you its value to state operations. Try to do that quickly because some of these activities also have a policy package that we'll talk about later. I believe the first one that you see on your page is centralized subrogation activities to recover losses. During the last 3 years, recovery efforts have brought in $976,000. The cost of the activity over the same period of time $185,000.
If you could give us an example, this is somebody that crashes into guardrail and wipes out a mile and a half of it, and you're going after them.
That's a perfect example, Madam Chair.
Okay. We've had experience with that, have you, Madam Chair? I'm just curious
absolutely
how you know that.
Absolutely not, under no circumstances. I'm just a keen observer, and I read a lot.
Okay.
We believe that return on investment represented by the amount of money that's been recovered versus the cost of the position is 5-1. Before we had this position, our average monthly collections were $2,200. The average monthly collection since we had the position is $29,000. And there's a policy package that that we'll talk about later related to this activity. We also centralize the purchasing of insurance and provide self-insurance coverage that reduces the cost of government. All insurance purchases on behalf of the state are managed by a two-person team rather than each agency providing staff for this function and not having a coordinated process to assure that adequate coverage is in place at agencies or that protect the state. The reuse of excess state and federal property enables the agency to reduce costs for office furniture and equipment. Statewide price agreements provide the lowest possible pricing for goods and services for agencies and local governments to purchase. These agreements are statewide, and they're also agency-specific. Agreements seek to capitalize on volume buying to obtain favorable pricing from vendors when that's possible.
Senator Morsett.
The reuse of excess property, in other words, if somebody gets rid of a piece of furniture do you then post that for somebody else? Do you move that around rather than just selling it on eBay? I mean, it implies that you're looking for a place to put that first.
Madam Chair, Representative Morissette, the answer to your question is yes. We make it available and anticipate and encourage agencies or other eligible local governments to come and utilize that equipment or property before we place it on eBay.
Is there any portal by which not-for-profits can enter that system?
Yes, there is, Madam Chair, and many do.
Do you have guidelines that you could make available to the committee? I'm just curious. We all have struggling not-for-profits in our districts that, for them, a file cabinet would be the difference between life and death, practically, and if we had the ability to share with them how that surplus property works in their benefit, that would be great.
Yes, Madam Chair, we'll follow up and do
Thanks.
That. Well, let's see. Oh, I just want to mention that some of the types of these price agreements that are in place are for trade and personal services, heavy equipment, IT software, collection services, and a multitude of public works projects. On the next page, page 19, I make a reference to Oregon Smart Buy. This is a totally new purchasing strategy for us. Discounted price agreements are not solely due to volume buying. Working with our consultant, Silver Oak, we are initiating strategic sourcing for specific categories of goods and services. This strategy requires extensive research on each product prior to issuing bids to determine market competition and benchmark pricing. The information indicates how we might best access the market and how we also might seek the best competitive price. What we're seeking is the best price, not just the lowest price. You get a lowest price when you request proposals or bids and you have a response from a certain number of vendors. You select the lowest price from that group. What we want to do with this research by identifying what is the regional benchmarking for the pricing, what vendors are in competition for the goods, and focus our direction on trying to identify those and move them into our process to where we get the best pricing when you consider all those things together.
Madam Chair.
Representative Krupp.
With David, interesting concept, and I'm very interested to see what results you have obtained so far. Have you implemented the strategy yet?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, we have, and I have some information to present a bit later in the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll reserve the remainder of my questions for that presentation.
I would also look forward to the rest of that presentation with specifically what guidance you give other agencies that are acquiring particularly very unique services. Given the drought, I think we're going to have a terrible forest fire season, and I'm curious how you're helping forestry, for example, if they are letting contracts for back diggers or heavy equipment, how forestry fits in, and what guidance you're able to give them as they're preparing their bid documents.
And I'm sure I'll follow up.
My particular interest in asking that is that in many cases forestry is contracting for some very unique goods and services, helicopters, air tankers, extremely expensive equipment. And having worked under those contracts in former lives, I'm just curious to what degree you're able to give guidance in this esoteric realm of buying goods and services for other agencies. Any assistance on maximizing their smart buying opportunities so that they could get one extra helicopter if they could save some money in their contracting?
Sure, I'll follow up on that.
Thank you.
I can't give you specifics today.
I know, and if it's a voluminous request, come back to me. I don't want to send you off down a rabbit hole hunting for stuff. We can talk about it.
Thank you. Just a couple other comments about Oregon Smart Buy. We seek vendors to offer discounted pricing for the components for the period of the contract. We had sought pricing for 12 categories that were initially selected. They range from office supplies to copiers to computer hardware, peripherals, and softwares. Projections for the 2003-2005 cost reductions ranged from $10 to $18 million. The updated projections that we have based on historical buying patterns and our what's actually been purchased is that we anticipate that for 2003-2005 we'll have cost reductions of $11.2 million. We did have some upfront costs that were $4.1 million, but we think that that indicates a cost benefit of more than 2.5 to 1 for the initial effort at instituting this strategy. We anticipate over the life of the agreement for the remaining for these 12 categories that an additional $40 million will be realized in cost savings for these agreements. Now that assumes that the buying patterns that we identified up front continue to be consistent over the period of time. That's the only way we can compare back. But if that all holds true, we believe we're going to see some significant cost reductions for state agencies.
What was the $4 million upfront cost?
$4 million upfront was related to seeking consulting advice from Silver Oak. This methodology for strategic sourcing is something that we did not have experience with, and so we asked them to come in and work with us to develop the methodologies, teach us how to do that, teach us how to do the analysis, seek the information on benchmarking, seek the information about how to determine a competitive marketplace. And so we're taking that they gave us, and our intent is to incorporate it across our staff so we can continue to do that activity but not be dependent upon constant consultant assistance to do that.
Where is Silver Oak, the company, located, and what other states do they assist that you know about?
Madam Chair, I believe their headquarters is in San Francisco, but they do have an office in Seattle. They have worked with Virginia, New Mexico, I remember specifically, and four other states. I just can't recall at the moment the other states that they currently have engagements with.
And how long is our relationship with them?
Our relationship began about a year ago. We're in for what we call Wave 1, which was specific to these 12 categories that I mentioned. They helped us establish a monitoring system as well so we can track the purchases to see how agencies are participating and using the agreements. We're on the downside of their Wave 1 participation. They've helped us establish the methodologies. They've helped us establish the monitoring methodology. What we're talking with them now would be a transition to what we're referring to as Wave 2. We're in discussions to finalize the categories for that activity. At the moment, we believe that's going to shrink a little bit from what we initially talked about. Some of the items that we're looking at are telecommunications and the related equipment tied to that, blade servers and mainframe equipment, postage meters. We also looked at lab supplies and consumables. We also looked at food. We talked with ODOT about emulsified asphalt. I think that's right. What we believe we're going to move towards, though, to spend our attention to is telecommunications and the peripherals related to that, blade servers and mainframe purchases, and postage meters. We think that those four categories give us the best bang for our buck, and we also need to recognize that internally we have a set number of staff, and there's just so much that we can incorporate in these new activities. And so we want to make sure we can sustain wave one. And so we want to be wise about what we select and move towards for wave two.
Madam Chair.
Representative Krupp, Senator, you're up to bat.
Okay, thank you. I think this is fascinating. It's really interesting that you're talking about it. And I'm looking at Appendix B, and there are some things that you've mentioned. But are you going to do some detailed reporting on what you just discussed, or could you? Well, let me jump ahead then and say I think that needs to be incorporated into a performance measure, because that certainly is something that is notable that you're doing. So I appreciate any other written information that you have, but I would like to see that as a performance measure.
Madam Chair, Senator Morrissey, we do have a rather detailed strategy or process about how we would do that, and I don't have it today, and I wasn't anticipating to include it in the presentation, but I can make that available.
I would like to
see
that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we're going to have to stop here. I know that we're just getting ready to get into your summary of the budget, but we're going to ask you to return on Monday. We're scheduled for Department of Administrative Services throughout the remainder of next week.
That is correct, Madam Chair. We are scheduling a field trip to Tuesday.
Right.
So that day will be to visit.
Field trip for what?
Look at the data center that they'll be moving out of, and then the new facility, because this data center consolidation is a significant issue to the state. And yesterday, the committee officer decided to go on a take a look at where they would be moving from. I think you'll be able to see what Mr. Foster was talking about, the need then to retrofit that building because it's been changed to house the computers there, and then the new facility for the consolidated data center operation.
This is an attempt to get us ready to deal with a $76 million line item placeholder so that we really understand on the ground what it is we're discussing.
And some other IRS.
And if you show up, we'll let you come along.
Now, just by way of summary, this again puts us a little bit behind. The field trip on Tuesday will put us further behind. And I just want to acknowledge that we're going to be struggling to get this budget completed by next week. But absent any questions from the panel, hearing none, I'm going to close the public hearing and possible work session on of Administrative Services. We invite Mr. Hartwig to come back on Monday to finish his presentation on state services, and we stand adjourned until Monday at 8:30. Thank you.
This is great.